Tonight on the Goblin's Corner, we're going to interview a proper mad scientist.
Proper indeed. Do you have a hankering to see creatures and all sorts of models created out of foam or otherwise? Then join us this evening as we speak with legendary effects and creature creator Russ Adams.
That's how we roll.
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 Welcome to the Goblin's Corner. My name is Eric.
And I'm Matt.
And tonight,
we're speaking to Russ Adams, a creature effect specialist.
That's right. Russ Adams is an effects artist and creature designer, best known for his work on Jim Henson's Creature Shop Challenge, and is the founder of Escape Design FX. Russ has a wide skill set due to many years working with Hollywood productions, as well as independent film and theater. He also has a badass minotaur, which is the kind of reason we have him here today. Russ, welcome to the show.
Hi, thanks, guys. I appreciate it.
So, we got to talk about the minotaur, which is the whole reason I got you on this show. So I want you guys to picture this for you playing the home game here is we're at Dragon Con. We walk into the Hall of Fame where people are signing autographs and stuff. And I see this 3-foot minotaur that is incredible. I'm like, all right, these famous, screw these famous people. I want to check out this minotaur. And I end up talking to, I believe it was your wife, about the minotaur. And then we start talking together, right? And I was like, I've got to get you on this show because we've got a lot of crafters as our listener base, as well as, you know, we do a little bit of crafting as well, some of the stuff over here. And gaming and crafting kind of go hand in hand. And I thought, what better person to talk about crafting and just making, you know, just really cool creatures and monsters than a person who actually does this for a living. So that's kind of how we started this whole thing out.
Sounds good.
Yeah.
Oh, I hate to be anal, but I just had like one. It's 42 inches, not 3 feet. So I'm
42 inches.
Well, there you go.
Sorry, that was.
Hey, no,
that
that's fair.
Didn't want to give the Minotaur a complex here. So we'll.
Yeah. You missed six inches of Minotaur on
I
that.
Can't believe, you know, that's true. That's very true. It's a very impressive Minotaur.
Thank you. I appreciate
eight.
It.
See, I can't do math either, but it's okay.
We broke Matt. Look at this. He's yeah. He's
I'm
dying.
Sorry, man.
No, it's okay. Know. My brain went sideways.
You know, matters.
Size matters. Size
yeah.
Matters. Size
yeah.
matters.
Exactly. My brain dropped into the gutter for a second, and I was like, where do I go with this? So, Russ, let's talk about how you got started with creature creation.
It's kind of a weird story. I just, you know, a lot of us that are, they call us creature kids, you know, who came up in like the 80s and, you know, there was no, you know, information out there that was readily available. I mean, this stuff was top secret. I mean, no one was sharing any of it. So we would tear things apart and, you know, like check out things like Fangoria magazine, looking for that one photo of the in process build that we could just, you know, kind of attack it like, you know, like we were casing a bank for a robbery. You know, we'd be in there with a magnifying glass just to see what was going on. And so basically it started with me watching an episode of Mr. Rogers' Neighborhood. And, you know, he's all about pretend and trying to make kids understand that, you know, that this wasn't real. And he was interviewing Lou Ferrigno, and they were showing how they transformed him into the Incredible Hulk for the original series. And I was watching that. I was hooked as a little kid. I was just hooked. So I started tearing things apart, which really made my parents happy. All the games with little motors in it and stuff.
Sure.
I'd start tearing apart. But we also didn't have a whole lot of money, which is kind of another characteristic for creature kids is, you know, we would build our own toys because, you know, you would covet like the Optimus Prime characters and stuff, but you couldn't afford them.
Yeah.
And so you'd make your own version of them, starting with paper, then with wood. Basically, that's just how it developed.
So you had Transformer taste, but GoBot budget.
Not even a GoBot budget. the paper bot budget was basically what we, what we had, but. You know, it was fun because you got to you don't realize it when you're that age and you're making things transform like you see, you know, because it was pointless to have a toy that was just the robot, you know, if it didn't transform. So you had to figure that out too. So basically, out of a block of wood, a couple, you know, scrap pieces of wood, you're creating these transformers, and you don't even realize it, but you're learning engineering skills and design skills and things like that. And it's like, I use algebra all the time, but if you put me in an algebra class, I'm going to fail it.
I understand that very well. I get that.
It's interesting how much you learn trying to build something as an artist. I always find it really interesting where, you know, you might be making something out of clay, you might be making something out of resin or, you know, what have you, right? And there's chemistry involved. Like you said, there's math involved, engineering. You've got to think about things in a 3D way. You also have to think about things in a linear path because you have to, there's multiple procedures and steps involved. Mm-hmm. So it takes a lot of know-how. It's not just I slap something together and call it a day. And so there's definitely like a process. Do you have a particular process with when you create like a creature?
It's kind of different for each one because it's all R&D until you get it right. You know, that whole fake it till you make it thing, you know. You know, you were talking about like, you know, the chemistry thing, knowing the rules of how to mix silicone or fiberglass resin, but then how to break those rules to what we do is like hot kick things. Cause I don't know a single FX artist who has an attention span longer than like this. So we don't want to wait the standard amount of time. We want that thing to be ready and pull out of that mold immediately. So you hot kick it, which, you know, can start a fire.
What is hot kicking?
Hot kicking is when, okay, say you have two chemicals, and you've got to mix them an A and B together. But a specific part of B says, hey, listen, these are supposed to be like 1-to-1. And you've decided, you know what, like in fiberglass, you're supposed to, you know, for a cup of resin, you add so much hardener and that's it. But we'll sometimes add 3 times the amount of hardener, knowing full well that there's a shrinkage issue, but also that it heats up even faster, but you get your part quicker. And it's like the difference of getting what you need in 24 hours versus maybe 2 hours, you know? So It's knowing how it's going to affect the end result, being okay with that and breaking the rules to get something faster, you know, but knowing all those issues, because you've made those mistakes in the past, you know how it's going to twist and warp. And oh my God, if there's too much humidity in a room, is this thing going to foam out instead of cast resin, or are you going to have something that appears to be like polyurethane foam block because the way the resin ballooned out and stuff like that. Math.
That's how they get you, is that math.
Oh, geometry. Holy crap. Some of the hardest things when we're trying to create a creature and, you know, you need to start with something like a ball, you know, just a sphere, you know, how do I make a sphere? I mean, it's a challenge. I mean, there's a formula that I have setting aside. As a matter of fact, it's on my phone. You know, I know what the formula is so that I can then, you know, create the proper strips, those weird eye-like looking strips, how many of those I need to complete the sphere, making sure that they're all the same. I mean, it's this weird amount of geometry. And like I said, I'd never be able to pass these classes in high school or even when I was getting my master's. I couldn't pass those math classes. I mean, I barely got through. But, you know, yeah, somehow you're doing it every day and you don't even realize it.
Geometry I was good at because it was such a functional math. Algebra, once it started dropping into theoretical math, my brain was just like, this doesn't seem like it's for me.
I have a science degree, so I mean, all right, amidst the other ones, but so I had to take a lot of math.
Yeah, I can imagine.
I don't use my science degrees anymore, but...
But you got them.
But I got them. Yeah,
they look nice.
They're on the wall.
It's impressive, man. I mean, science degree. I mean, you know, it's like holy crap. We got a badass in the room. You know, it's
nah, there's a reason it's a BS. Like it stands for BS for a reason. So let's say you're an aspiring creature builder. Let's say you've never made anything from scratch. What are maybe a couple of easy things that you could start out with if you're a beginner?
If you're just getting into it, one of the best things to play with is foam. I mean, it's cheap. It's readily available. I mean, basically everything from cosplayers to special effects artists, creature designers, prop makers, we're all using it's a foam that's most commonly, suggested. The name is EVA foam, but when we're talking about it in a studio setting, it's L200. It's basically the same thing. One just comes in smaller sheets that are a little more user friendly. You can get them just about anywhere. Whereas L200, there's like only specialized places, foam factory, outlets that'll sell that, and mark it up in a ridiculous, number. But I would say play with some foam, because by playing with the EVA foam, you're learning a bunch of different skills. You're learning how to pattern, which is critical. I mean, I do just as much sewing as I do sculpting or casting or painting. You learn how to bend space and get it to hold position, and it's really inexpensive material. Like I think, you could go down to Home Depot. You can go down to Harbor Freight and pick up these floor mats, which is EVA foam, for I think it's $9.99, and there's a pack of four, and they're basically 2 feet by 2 feet. And just go nuts for $10. I mean, and some glue, you're learning, by screwing around with that stuff.
Go to yard sales and pick up old yoga mats.
Yeah, you totally pick up yoga mats. And you can make everything out of it. People make helmets out of it.
Oh, yeah.
You can watch YouTube and YouTube's great for stuff like this, because you just fall down a rabbit hole in terms of making props and stuff like that, particularly for Dragon Con and such. Mm-hmm. And they'll have guns that they've made out of just foam, weapons. We come from the LARPing universe. So we made a lot of stuff with, what was it, Matt? The pool noodle foam?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. You got open cell foam. You've got, I use a lot of upholstery foam. I don't know if people would realize that, but when I'm doing these giant Bigfoot suits, gorilla suits, werewolf suits, you have to create, a muscle structure underneath there, an artificial muscle structure. So you're using a combination of the EVA foam or L200 and the upholstery foam and some styrofoam, because you got to keep the weight down, to carve out these muscles and get them to move on a spandex track so that they move naturally. Hmm. And I don't think a lot of people think of it. How do they get that muscle structure underneath there? Cause it slides underneath the fur and stuff and actually looks like muscle movement. All that stuff is incredibly useful. Styrofoam, upholstery foam, basically whatever foam. AB foam, you can mix that stuff together. It gets a little more expensive at that point, and you need things like molds and stuff, but basically foam is inexpensive, and it's a subtractive material in that, if you cut something wrong, you can glue it together and fix it or whatever, but if you want it to be polished, you have to get to the point where you've worked out the R&D and you're able to cut those things properly and get them to bend the space and everything to make them work. But there's nothing cheaper than playing with foam and having a blast at it.
That's cool. I like messing around with just different things like that. And of course, we do a lot of cardboard suits and stuff for our kids, which is, if you got a cardboard box, man, you can make a fun suit or some kind of
cardboard superheroes.
Yeah.
For Dragon Con.
Oh, yeah.
Well, my kids for last year for Halloween were firebenders from the Avatar cartoon, and I literally just made the firebender armor out of cardboard. But you could do the same thing with EVA foam, and it would actually look probably a lot better than what I did. But it's a great place to start, right?
Yeah, exactly. I didn't even think about cardboard, but yeah, cardboard is great because you can use things like masking tape to hold it together. Instead of with foam, we use. There's a bunch of different stuff you can use, but I had some of it here. We use this stuff called barge, and it's a contact cement. Mm-hmm. And it is really toxic stuff. I mean, it's the stuff that they use to put soles on the bottom of shoes and stuff to hold it together. A lot of saddle makers will use it to hold saddle, you know, leather together and stuff. But it's really, really nasty stuff. But if you're using cardboard, you could get the same results and just use some masking tape to kind of, you know, hold everything together. The cool thing about, you know, I've seen Iron Man suits, incredibly beautiful Iron Man suits and raw cardboard that I was like, this one guy, I was begging him not to paint it. Don't finish that thing at all. I mean, the fact that you have a raw cardboard Iron Man suit that looks like it's film ready. God, I mean, it was incredible to look at. It moved properly and
wow.
Just cardboard, man. I mean, it was a full size suit. I geek out over the weirdest shit. But yeah, that raw cardboard, it kind of like, I'm gonna go off on a little bit of a tangent. I apologize, but it reminds me of when I was working with the Weber State University on an Elizabethan gown that we had essentially created this incredibly intricate Elizabethan gown out of muslin, just raw muslin. It was just this off-white, you know, and it was the most amazing looking thing when we were all done with it. And it kind of harkened back to that when I saw that, you know, that Iron Man suit.
I would have loved to seen the that Iron Man, that cardboard Iron Man. That would have been awesome.
That would have been great.
It was incredible. I think you can still find it on YouTube and like searches on Google. I didn't see it at Dragon Con. It was a build that somebody was doing. And had I had the money to pick that thing up, I would have totally rescued it from any kind of finishing work, because I would have loved to have that thing on a mannequin just sitting, you know, in my office and just looking at it on a daily basis, completely, you know, mesmerized by it doesn't take these incredible chemicals and, you know, CNC routers and, you know, 3D printers and all this stuff to create something amazing like that. It took that guy a box knife, some masking tape, and a lot of patience, you know. But,
and I think, you know, that's what it comes down to, is the what is it, the triangle of crafting. It's either quality, time, or money, and you can only ever short shift one of those.
I am glad you brought that up, though, because it, you know, regardless of whether you're working with dungeon terrain like we do, or you're doing some kind of fine work like doing a costume for Dragon Con, or you're making stuff on movies, you don't always have to have the latest and greatest machine to make something. And in fact, sometimes, like you said, a box knife and a little bit of grit will get you through things. This, one of the things I see a lot is you'll have these crafters who have all of the toys, and at somewhere along the line, they kind of make it harder for people who are trying to get into it, because, you know, if I look at that, I might be very hesitant to, because there's a lot of like stuff I got to buy, right? And so you think, oh man, the entry level for this is just super huge. But really, you start with something, like you said, start with some EVA foam, start with just something that's simple, and start playing with that, and then build your materials as time progresses.
This isn't exactly a big secret, but whenever it does come up, I like to talk about it. So you guys remember Men in Black? There was a scene, it lasted, I don't even know if it was two full seconds, maybe less, where, you know, Will Smith and Tommy Lee Jones walk past this bubble creature in the Men in Black, you know, place. They're coming in and they're doing like food inspection. Do you have anything to declare? Blah, blah, right. Blah. Making it like an airport. And there's this bubble creature, and it's this gelatin looking thing. And it was created by the gods of special effects, you know, the Stan Winston studio, and their amazing, artists. But it was basically a couple of bags, a couple of boxes of kitchen bags, and they used this weld thing where they were able to cut those pieces, those geometric shapes and stuff. But the way they cut it, it would melt the plastic together and create a seam. And then they just inflated it, painted it, and airbrushed it from inside and out, and stuck a guy in there that you couldn't really see. And I don't know how many tens of thousands of dollars. I've heard, you know, around like $100,000+ for this creature that was on air for something like less than 2 seconds. It was in the film, and it cost them $20-$30 in kitchen bags to put this thing together. And if I remember correctly, Billy, and I'm struggling to remember Billy's last name. Billy was high as a kite when he came up with the concept, and he was blowing, he was smoking and blowing it into a garbage bag, tying it off and letting it float away up in the rafters of the studio. And, you know, that's how he came up with the idea. And it was just like, they made so much money off that one creature. And it cost them nothing to make, nothing but time.
That's Hollywood, guys.
Yep.
That's it. You know, and that's a sad thing because, you know, you put that kind of effort, that level of effort into something and make something amazing. And it just goes in the garbage. Like, people don't realize that the suits that I make, that I charge $10,000, $20,000 for, I have to be okay with the fact that someone's going to wear it. And when they wear it, they're going to sweat inside it. Then it's going to become a biohazard. You know, so you can't just sell that to somebody else. Now it's got, you know, it's got humid fluids in it, drying and getting all kinds of nasty because it's essentially a sponge, you know, and you can hang it up and air it up and disinfect it as much as you can. But the same actor's getting in that the next day. So he's only kind of like stewing in his own juices, not somebody else's. And when the shot's done and when the film is over, it goes in the garbage unless someone rescues it and sticks it on a mannequin. And, you know, they should have a waiver on it and saying, hey, listen, please, for the love of God, don't put this thing on. You're going to get infantago or something, you know, but it goes in the garbage. So, you know, these guys, you know, at Stan Winston Studios, you know, putting together this garbage bag creature, you know, knowing full well is going in the garbage. I mean, now they've reduced their footprint of how much trash they created for this creature. And only spent $20, whatever, on those bags, on those kitchen garbage bags, and created something that they made hundreds of thousands of dollars off of. You know, it's just
those garbage bags were going to end up in the landfill anyway.
Yeah, that's incredible.
Exactly.
They probably took the prop and, you know, put the food from the food truck in the prop just to throw away.
They probably did. And, you know, I mean, it's just, you know, you get on. There's so little sentimentality that goes on with some of these pieces that we create. You know, you're almost in shock and horror. And if you're not in shock and horror, then you know you're a veteran of the industry. It's the noobs that come in and they see that they've just sliced and diced up their hard work and they're just like, they're ready to cry, you know? And it's like, oh, he must be new. You know, it's sad, but
it's all for the story. Know. All for the story, though.
That's it.
So story is a lot of what we talk about. How much does the story and the theme come into play when you're creating a creature?
It's quite a bit because, you know, a lot of times you'll have the script in front of you and you're pulling apart all the aspects that are related to the creature, its movements, why it's like that. Maybe you even fabricate some of your own backstory in there to help move the process along. But specifically when you're creating something of your very own, like if we harken back real quick to that television show I was on, the Jim Henson Creature Shop Challenge, you know, they would tell us, this is the creature we want you to make. This is what it does. Go. And you have to figure out how to make it work. And the backstory can describe everything from why it's the color it is, the mating rituals, you know, how it attracts a mate, you know, its speed, the way it attacks prey, if it is prey, the way it escapes. All of that stuff needs to be rolling around in your head, even if it's not in a script form, because that's going to determine how your character moves and acts and its presence. So, you know, we would have to do that stuff. Now, to be completely honest, a lot of bullshit happened, you know, because you're creating these creatures and you have something like 10 hours a day for 2 days, 3 days, if you're lucky, to create a creature, you know, for essentially to be camera ready and on set. And it was a nightmare. I mean, a lot of people were like, hey, you had more time than that. No, we did not. You didn't even have that full 10 hours because they're pulling you out to do interviews and crap like that. So in the midst of creating this stuff, you might make a mistake here and there. And you might, you know, like a friend of mine, and I love Lex to death. She's like my British little sister. She was on the show with us and she ran out of time and she couldn't finish a creature. I think it was episode 4. And so she started this backstory where little bits of the creature were, you know, disappearing. You know, it was part of the story, you know, and so it didn't have any eyelids. Why doesn't it have eyelids, Lex? I mean, she's a professional. We're all professionals, you know, but, you know, you only have so much time right. doing this stuff in that particular episode by ourselves. So she was running out of time. And I'm going to throw this off. It was a lot of having to do with their ridiculous mech setup that didn't fit. Parts just didn't freaking fit. And so they would waste a lot of time with that. And so her eyelids are missing and stuff. She's turned this thing into the subject of a magician's, you know, who was Donald Faison, his faulty magical abilities. And he's teleporting her, but only pieces are going at a time. And that's how Lex created a backstory to cover her ass, you know, for essentially a creature that didn't get finished. And it was friggin' brilliant.
That's great. I mean,
you know, we all knew it was bullshit, but it was brilliant. You know, it was a perfect way to cover that up. So backstory is important. It's also important to cover your ass when you're creating something and you screw up.
This sounds exactly like being a DM. When you're creating creatures, half of it's BS.
Exactly.
Oh yeah.
Yeah. Seriously, half of it's bullshit, and the other half is thinking about consequence of actions when it comes to the story. Right. So, like Matt and I, we've got tons of episodes where we make creatures for people because we love making monsters. Right. And so, for example, we have a beholder shark, which is one of my favorite creatures that we've come up with so far, which is a beholder and a shark all in one. It's almost as good as my phase mosasaur, which is a mosasaur that phases back and forth from reality. But we have to think about stuff like, hey, how does it eat? How does it breed? And, you know, we usually just give it the bullet points and then the rest of it's BS, which right. is exactly how most DMs work. Or if they don't, they should, because that's the fun part of being a DM. You know, you got to do a little improv. And it's nice to hear that the physical creation of creatures also requires thinking through the consequence of actions and a little bit of bullshit and improv.
Yeah, a lot. Yeah. It really is. Yeah. It's, you know, I do like the phasing, Moses. Is it sort of like how it explains Nessie? I mean, that you can't find her.
Yeah. You know what a phase spider is in D&D? It's like a spider that lives on the ethereal plane and just kind of phases into reality and bites people and then phases back out of reality. Well, I thought that was really cool, and I wanted a mosasaur that did that. And you're just walking along, and this mosasaur pops out of nowhere, bites your head off, and just phases back into the ethereal plane.
That's fantastic. That's fantastic.
It's mostly because we're terrible people.
I mean, you know, my players like it.
You know, there's always the X factor. You know, you have to be ready. You know,
that's right. Got to be ready for anything
in life and in D&D. You know.
So we've been talking about props. We've been talking about creature models. We've been talking a little bit about games. This is where a tabletop show. Obviously, we concentrate a lot about that. What is it about creatures in general, or I would even say just effects in general, that you think really add to any type of story? You could be movies or even visual aids in the theater or props. What do you think about the creativity and the craft that really adds to stories?
Harkening back to what we were just talking about the backstory and everything. I mean, if it's a character that is just imaginary, right? And you're having to visualize it in your mind's eye to make it work, there it sounds like, you know, you say something like werewolf or whatever, and not everybody's going to see a werewolf the exact same way. And so by giving it these details, you're now pulling everyone onto the same, you know, sheet of paper. Everyone understands that this isn't like some Twilight piece of crap, you know, where it's just a big dog, you know, or I guess that was
tell
the
me
same
how you feel
True
about
Blood.
That, Russ.
Yeah, nothing I hate more than Twilight ruined vampires for generations to come. Werewolves. You know what? If I had some alcohol in me, this would go on way longer. Anyway, so, you know, but I mean, everyone sees a wolf man, you know, yeah. the old version, that's basically a werewolf. I mean, different variations, you know, everyone has to be on the same page. So the more detail that's poured into these characters helps pull people in. It's basically the same. The only thing is it's a cheat what I do, you know, because where you guys are creating a character that needs to be fleshed out among however many people are there with you, and everyone has to see it the same way through description, I just show them, you know, and I think that's a lot of the problem where people are reading books, you know, and then they see the movie version and they don't quite like it, because what they saw in their mind's eye wasn't what we had created in our mind's eye, mm-hmm. and brought into the world and put on the screen. So that's a lot of the aspect of it that sort of causes that animosity, you know, mm-hmm. when you're talking about things like, you know, oh, the movie wasn't as good as the book and blah, blah, blah. That's because you're allowed to create all that stuff in your head and make it even grander than you could possibly create in the real world.
Yeah.
So when we bring it into the real world, we try really hard, you know, to make that magic happen, but you're showing them instead of telling them. And, you know, we've all heard, you know, stories are best, you know, through, you know, the whole, you know, telling the story and stuff like that, and crafting, you know, the description, as opposed to here it is, you know. So what we do is a bit of a cheat, in my opinion, and what you guys do is way more in depth and primordial, you know. It really gets, you know, the people involved and seeing everything the same way.
It's true and it's not true. Here's the thing. If I say there's a monster, it looks like a hybrid between an octopus and a spider. No matter how much detail I give you past that, your brain already went, if you dislike either spiders or octopi, it doesn't matter what I say after that. Your brain has created something worse than whatever my description is going to be, because you're just like, nope, 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 nope.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's a hell beast. Just say hell beast. That's all I need to know.
But does it have teeth?
Well, of course it has teeth.
It has teeth and a beak.
Yeah. Now, I will say this, though. You know, just there are plenty of examples, too, where a good prop or a good creature told the story. I'll go back to John Carpenter's The Thing. Right? We talk about some creatures and stuff. Like, that versus the CGI version of The Thing. Two different things, right? Like, the way that they did the monster in The Thing, it's horrible today. I've seen that movie. I don't know how many times I've seen that movie. But the way that the creature effects were, and they were just using basically bladders to simulate, like, the guts and all that stuff and how it's shape-shifting. Same thing with, what was it, Werewolf in London, where they were using bladders on the face to make the werewolf change and stuff like that. That process, there's an art form to it. And I know you've done a lot of different stuff like that, too. If you do it right, which you get, you know, which you've obviously done, it does tell the story, and it does enhance the story way better than sometimes a description could be, too.
Yeah, but it can also really screw it up. I mean, the cool thing about American Werewolf in London was that transformation was all one shot. You know, they had this little apparatus that they would crank, and the interior would move and stretch back, and, you know, and that face was actually elongating. You know, most amazing thing. It'll always be probably, you know, one of the most Oscar worthy, you know, creature transformations in history.
They did that in one shot?
Yeah, it was all, like, everything was just, you know, set up so that so that they couldn't cheat by cutting, you know, like where they would have the creature in mid transformation and then they would kind of cut over to maybe a hand or something and cut back, and he's mostly trans No, they wanted this thing to transform in front of people's faces. And if you go on YouTube and you kind of, you know, look around for the behind the scenes of that, they'll show you the mechanism, this amazing mechanism that was working underneath that to turn that guy's head into a werewolf. I mean, it was just it was incredible. It will always be like probably, you know, the most iconic thing in my head. I know I'm not the only one, but I think I went off on a tangent and I forgot what we were actually talking about. Sorry about that.
No, it's great. Tangents are kind of what we do anyway.
Sure. Where my head is at is like, there are masterful ways to visually tell a story. Like, I always think of Alfred Hitchcock and Psycho, right? And so Psycho, you never even see Norman Bates kill up until I think the last part, if I'm right. It's been so long since I've seen the movie, but mostly you just see the shadow and the dagger in the hand. And so there are ways to enhance, but then show with the creatures.
Yeah. My wife and I were just having a conversation. I want to say it was even last night that we were talking about some of the scariest things that we had ever seen, you know, even as kids, and trying to include in, you know, that. And I don't remember the movie. I don't, but I remember this scene where there's a doorway, like a big archway leading from a living room into a foyer and staircase going up the stairs. And this kid, probably, I don't know, 6, 8 years old, goes walking to the stairs, and there's a ball that there's nobody up there, but this ball starts bouncing down the stairs. And this kid looks up the stairs and had you completely paralyzed with fear, because that's what he was projecting. You didn't see, and you never saw what was up those stairs. It was a ball coming down the damn stairs. And that has scarred me to the point. And now I remember why it came up, because we were watching this Guillermo del Toro movie. It just came out.
Shape of Water?
No, not The Shape of Water. I think it's more recent, but there was a ball rolling out of nowhere.
Oh, gotcha.
To this woman and a dog. And I was like, holy shit, I remember from my childhood, blah, blah, blah. And I'm going off about these stairs, right? And you're right. You don't ever see anything. And because your mind was left to terrorize yourself, God only knows what was at the top of those stairs.
Crimson Peak.
The movie.
Is it Crimson Peak?
Yeah.
Yeah, it had these elements that were terrifyingly elegant, if that makes any sense to you. There was a certain almost Day of the Dead feeling to it, you know, to these characters, you know, these ghosts that were coming out of the woodwork and stuff. It was really cool in that respect, but those were really cool. CGI, completely CGI, clearly CGI. But we won't hold that against them.
So I want to talk about pirates real quick, because you did some stuff for Pirates of the Caribbean. And what specific creature effects and special effects were you working on with that?
Oh, man. Okay, so the first thing you need to understand is there are thousands of people working on that project. I mean, so, you know, I say, yeah, I got the credit. It's IMDb, yay, all that stuff. I was basically on a team of people who were putting together some skeletons and stuff like that. We were rigging things up and working on that. I didn't get to work on the makeup and stuff, you know, the stuff that really kind of gets people's attention, you know. But, you know, in Hollywood, gig's a gig. You know?
Sure.
So you take it. And because of the way it was shot, we kind of got credit for both films because they were kind of shot at the same time, you know. So sort of like Lord of the Rings, how... Wasn't it the last film that they just shot everything at once?
Yeah, and, they you know, shoot them out of order sometimes too.
Yeah, yeah. So, you know, I mean, it was a great experience, but basically, you don't really get to, you know, to do much other than your job, and then there's a lot of sit around and wait. You know, it's like, thank God for the military, because I learned hurry up and wait. You know, for 10 years, you know, it was just. It was ingrained, so it was more of the same when I got there to, you know, to work on that.
True facts. Speaking of games, you have an RPG version of a comic. So talk to us a little bit about Beginnings the Rift, an Order of the Veil adventure.
I've been telling, trying to create this story for, it's been a good 30 years now. And it started out as a comic book. Then I tried to, you know, put it in a novel form, and I couldn't focus on that. Then I put it in a script form back to the comic book. So I'm still working on the comic. I've actually nearly finished the first book. A buddy of mine just before COVID hit. It was January 2020. And a buddy of mine who has been trying to get me to do these, D&D and RPG projects, you know, just to play, you know, I call him up and I was like, hey, you know, I had an idea for this. You know, I want to see if we could turn this into an RPG. And, you know, his name's Dave Knighton, and Dave's all about it. And, you know, we start putting this thing together. And we created the first book. So we put it out on a platform called Drive-Thru RPG. And there it's been kind of like sitting. And, you know, we've been trying to figure out ways of promoting it, you know, and with me getting, you know, booked because of the Jim Henson Creature Shop Challenge, getting booked at conventions, I was like, you know, well, this is a great way, you know, for us to get it out there. You know, I'm basically being paid to be there anyway. You know, why not promote, you know, the RPG? And then I started thinking, it was like, I just did all this artwork for the book, you know, and so maybe I should go back to focusing on the comic book. So the RPG version comes out way before the comic book dies, but the story's still there.
And we'll have the link in the description below. So go check that out as well. Yeah, right there. Cool. Right there in the YouTube channel. If you're not listening to the YouTube, that's okay. We'll also have it on our site someplace.
I appreciate it. Thank you, guys.
Now, I do have a question of the week.
Excellent.
We do a question of the week for, obviously, every week, hence the name. If you were going to do, at a role-playing table, if you were going to do a special effect to enhance the mood, what would you want to do?
God, I would like to do atmosphere. I mean, you know, like, it would depend on the situation, but, you know, dropping the temperature, you know, in the room. You know, creating some kind of
nice,
you know, not so much smoke, but cold, mm-hmm. You know, because the temperature has dropped and that cold, you know, carbon smoke, you know, and, you know, some really cool, like, blue lighting and stuff for the proper, you know, I think that would be amazing because it adds that fourth dimension to, you know, what you're doing.
About to kill a white dragon and you've got dry ice all over the room.
Yeah.
The AC's on. That would be awesome. The blue light.
It'd be really nice if you just had fans and coolers so that you could hit a button and actually release the cold.
Oh, yeah. And, you know, I wouldn't even I'd do it from underneath the table because, I mean, sure. The less people can see what's coming,
yeah,
the better. And there was this nightclub in Las Vegas years ago. I think it was called Club Ice. And on the floor, they had this carbon dioxide machine, dry ice machine. It was huge, and it would blow out cold air to the point where it's getting that smoke, that same, you know, that same effect,
right.
You know, the dry ice effect, but it would literally lower the temperature like 25 degrees in the club. So when people are dancing, they would put this thing on, and it would, you never knew when it was going to go off. Just go off, nice. And the whole freaking room would just drop.
Like smoke would come off degrees. The bodies because they've been dancing.
Yeah,
yeah, that's cool.
Exactly. It was just the coolest thing, and I think adding something like that underneath, I mean, to just release it in a way that, number one, didn't spook any of the players because of the fact that, you know, you want them to stay seated and not turn over the damn table, you know, when they're freaking out about the cold. But if I had my way, I would, you know, somehow release that under the table and, you know, and just maybe some ice sound effects in the background.
That's fantastic. You know, that,
nice.
Yeah, that breaking glass kind of, you know, I think that would be cool.
That would be very cool. What about you, Eric?
I would do smell. That's going to be the atmospheric effect. I would have various scents that maybe I've collected if I knew that we were coming out. So we'll say volcano, right? You're going to fight a red dragon in a nice volcanic caldera. Then maybe I would have the scent of some kind of burnt flesh, right? Because, you know, there's got to be some dead bodies lying around. Maybe that smell of fire, you know, that almost that stark smell of fire where it's maybe kick the heat, maybe have a heater directly underneath the table. Maybe I'll set the table on fire and see what people do about that. And I wouldn't do that. But I might have like maybe some burnt leaf smell or I don't know, something interesting about that because smell and memory are very closely linked. And so I think that would be really interesting. Matt, what about you? We've gotten kind of environment touch and feel. We've got smell. What are you going for?
As is our way. I've got a couple of different answers.
Of course.
One, if I were setting up like a ritual type situation, you pull the wicks out of the candles, do half of them as color flame wicks, and then pull them back through so that you've basically got a timer. And as you're telling the story, the candles are burning down. You know that they're about to change color, but nobody else at the table does.
Oh, that's cool. That would be great for 10 candles, too, which if you haven't heard of this, Russ, it's a game where you literally sit in the dark and 10 candles and you tell ghost stories about the end of the world. And then whenever someone rolls and they fail, you take a candle out and they're dead until you sit alone in the room with your friends with one candle until the light
That's
goes out.
That's awesome. I've never heard of that.
It is a creepy ass game. It's wonderful. You should check that out.
You start out with a bunch of extra dice based off of how many candles you have. And as you lose candles, the DM gain or you lose candles, you lose dice, and the DM gains the dice to use against you.
Oh, wow.
So it only gets worse.
That's fantastic. As life.
Yeah. That's exactly right. Yeah. Just like life.
Only gets worse.
You know, I love scents. I like cooking and playing with taste. If there were a way to, there are ways to actually aerosolize flavors. So you start talking about, you know, going into the bar and like a big steaming plate of food hits the table. And then, you know, you aerosolize a little bacon flavor and some stuff like so that you can literally taste it like you're there.
So you're up there with like a little mister just spraying people.
I don't know. I'd have an atomizer off to the side and hit a button so they wouldn't know it was coming.
That's cool.
Yeah.
That is all like, you know, like copper. Because, I mean, you know, you get that taste in your mouth. There's enough blood.
Yep. Yeah.
You know, you can actually, you know, taste it. And then you smell that copper smell. And that's the smell of blood. I mean, that would freak a lot of people out.
That would be great for a horror game. Like have just like a copper scent.
Yeah, you know, and while we're talking about that, it always kind of like when you're watching a horror movie, specifically like zombies and stuff. You know, everyone's trying to race around, trying to get away from them or control the population. No one really delves into what that smells like. You know, I mean, you're talking about a mass amount of rot and decay.
Oh, yeah.
And no one's gagging when this is going on. No one's like throwing up or, you know, trying to hold back so much that they've got snot running out of their face. I mean, that's, I think, the reality of it. You
sure.
know, I mean, so like the games like we're talking about, you know, it's almost like, you know, I wish, you know, smell-o-vision was a thing, you know. So when they're chased by these creatures, I mean, there is that smell. I wondered why no one has ever, to my knowledge, you know, tried to create that. You
because
know?
Of that zombie would, movies.
No, there you go. That would stink. But think about the cooking shows. Oh my God. You know?
Yeah. I mean, then there's also porn. And I don't know if I want that smelling in my house the whole
oh,
time.
Oh, yeah. That's a good. Yeah. That's going to be friend, stuck in my head all
you,
night.
You
yeah.
know, you watched a porn the night before, your friends come over to your house and they're like,
why does it smell like bleach in here?
Yeah. What's going on here?
That was it. Yes.
Russ, where can interested folks go to get more info?
Basically, I mean, you can check me out on TikTok. I'm always doing how-to videos. And right now, as I learn the comic book, you know, process, I'm doing all these videos from a complete novice, you know, idiot's perspective, you know, after doing a year's worth of research, trying to make sure that I do it right. And so if you go to TikTok, it's just, Russ Adams Official. And that's how they can get me there. Facebook, I'm popping in and out of there from time to time. That's just look up Russ Adams and you'll see my nasty little mug there. I've got a website, escape, design and the letters fx.com. Thinking we're probably going to do some revamping on that. So if you do check it out and it's down, it's probably just being, you know, revamped, cause it's getting dated, you know, but yeah, those are the big ones. I've tried Instagram and stuff like that. I just cannot make that work, man. I can't make Twitter work. I can't make Instagram work. I don't know how people do that. More power to them.
That's a great question. I'm active on Twitter, but I don't know that it's working.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Russ Adams is an FX artist and creature designer and founder of Escape Design FX. Russ, it's been a pleasure. We've had a blast. Thanks so much for being on our show.
Thanks, guys. I really appreciate it.
Any questions or comments? Hit us up at Goblins Corner on Twitter. Did you like this interview? We hope so. Subscribe to the podcast on your favorite player, YouTube or Twitch.
Click the 5 stars and give us a review on iTunes and Podchaser. If you're watching us on YouTube, hit the like and subscribe button. It helps get our show in front of more people. It boosts the show and it feeds the hungry algorithm.
Which is currently a 42-inch Minotaur made of EVA foam creeping up from behind. That's all the time we have for tonight. Once again, my name is Eric.
And I'm Matt.
We'll see you next time.
Good night, folks.
The Goblin's Corner is written and produced by Eric Holden and Matt Staples. Show song by the mighty D20. Don't we love that guy?
Sure.
This is a Subterranean production.